including Desert Island Discs on Fridays, from this week here on BBC Radio 4.
On 198 Longwave and DAB Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by Sister Gemma Simmons. Here on FN, Damian Lewis continues to read from Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, our book of the week. The new biography of the great American playwright is by the theatre critic John Lahr. In today's episode, depression and drink have taken a grip on the now 43-year-old Williams. A new play captures his inner turmoil.
In the spring of 1954, Williams picked up A Place of Stone, a short play that he hadn't been able to get a grip on when he started it the previous year, and that had added to his terrible state of depression last summer in Europe. Although he judged the new play too brief and too wordy, Williams saw that he had found a new imaginative scene. In Rome that summer, when his agent Audrey Wood was visiting, Williams handed her a pile of pages he called his work script, typed mostly on hotel stationery. By then, the play was called Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Wood stayed up reading until 4 in the morning.
I was terribly excited. In the morning, I immediately told him this was certainly his best play since Streetcar, and it would be a great success.
When Williams showed Wood the working script, he was, he said,
passing through, and still not out of the worst nervous crisis of my nervous existence. I'm just holding on. Liquor and Seconal are my only refuge, and they are not unfailing.
In 1940, he had confessed to the director, Margaret Webster, that he had begun to develop a sort of insulation about my feelings so I won't suffer too much. She replied, "That's a very dangerous thing for a writer." The observation had caught Williams's attention. 15 years later, he recounted,
"Once the heart is thoroughly insulated, it's also dead. My problem is to live with it, and to keep it alive."
His feverish internal debate between the dead heart and the outcrying heart was built into the early structure of the script, which laid out the battle between the despondent alcoholic Brick, son of Big Daddy Pollitt, the Delta's biggest cotton planter, and his beautiful, frustrated wife, Maggie, who wants both her husband's love and an heir to claim her dying father-in-law's wealth. Williams came to understand the play as a synthesis of all my life. In Brick and Maggie's battle, Williams projected the war inside himself between self-destruction and creativity. Brick, on crutches, he has broken an ankle in a drunken attempt to relive his glory days as a high school athlete, is literally and metaphorically hobbled by his melancholy. He is, as his name indicates, inert. His life is the living death of resignation. He has thrown in the towel. Maggie, by contrast, is all combat. Her hat, as she says, is in the ring, and she's determined to win. She wants Brick, she wants life, she wants especially to create a new life with Brick.
"Born poor, raised poor, expect to die poor unless I manage to get us something out of what Big Daddy leaves when he dies of cancer."
Brick blames her for the death of Skipper, his beloved friend and former football teammate. As he lashes out at Maggie, just missing her with swipes of his crutch, she forces him to face the truth.
"Skipper is dead. I'm alive. Maggie the cat is alive. I am alive, alive. I am alive."
Through Maggie, Williams gave a voice to his own imminent emotional atrophy. For Williams to keep his heart open, he had to lacerate it.
"There is torment in this play, violence and horror that reflects what I was going through or approaching as I wrote it. Perhaps if I'd not been so tormented myself, it would have been less authentic. Because I could not work with the old vitality, I had to find new ways."
Rather like an actor who stays in character offstage in order not to lose the reality of his performance, Williams had become a connoisseur of his own collapse. He took himself right up to the precipice so that he could stare into it. While Williams was creating a drama around Brick's permanent state of inebriation, he too had formed an unrepentant appetite for what he jauntily called a drinky pie.
When you're feeling sorry, when you start to sigh, honey, what you're needing is a little drinky pie.
Such anthems aside, Williams's drinking was no laughing matter. He admitted,
"It has gotten so bad I don't dare to turn down a street unless I can sight a bar not more than a block and a half down it."
Williams was becoming simultaneously an actor and a voyeur, an exhibitionist and a spectator of his own suffering. He was scaring himself into new literary life. Elia Kazan had written Williams on Christmas Day, 1953,
"For the new year, may you write a play and may I direct it."
With two consecutive Broadway financial failures to his name, Williams needed a hit, and Kazan was a hit maker. After reading Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, however, he pulled no punches. He believed that Williams had written a brilliant first draft, but he was convinced that there was more to do. He said,
"Please don't rush into production. I'm scared to death to embark with you on this play before the script is ready."
In the play, Big Daddy, on stage or off, is the focus of the other character's attention. It is his 65th birthday, and the household is celebrating his apparent clean bill of health after a struggle with cancer. He is the play's thematic catalyst, calling out the ambition in Maggie, the greed in his other son, Gooper, and the self-delusion in Brick. Despite the majestic energy of Big Daddy's personality and the brilliant extravagance of his talk, Williams, in his original conception of the play, did not bring him back in Act 3. Instead, having learned from Brick that the family has kept his terminal prognosis from him, Big Daddy exits in Act 2 and climbs up on the Belvedere. The banishment of Big Daddy from the last act was a narrative mistake. Wood remarked on it, Kazan jumped on it.
"The third act just plain loses me. I want to know what Big Daddy does after he's been told. This play is just not ready to have conferences about yet. That's the plain, plain, plain truth."
On receiving Kazan's set of notes, Williams couldn't sleep. Nonetheless, at 8 the next morning, he was at the typewriter, determined. The prototype for Maggie's desperation, ruthlessness, and hyperbolic flair was his great friend, Maria Brittneva, to whom the play is dedicated. Brittneva's flirtatiousness and her rapacity, her humiliated heart and her grandiose sense of entitlement were the elements from which Williams distilled much of Maggie's manic vitality. And he insisted,
"Vitality is the hero of the play. The character you can root for is not a person, but a quality in people that makes them survive."
By November 1954, Williams had turned in his revisions to Kazan. They talked, and Kazan produced another 5-page letter of director's notes about the outstanding problem, the dramatization of Brick, whose mystery for Williams was
"the poem of the play, not its story, but the poem of the story."
He had come to the narrative conclusion that Brick did love Skipper, whom he identified with sports.
"The romantic world of adolescence, which he couldn't go past, I now believe that, in the deeper sense, not the literal sense, Brick is homosexual with a heterosexual adjustment."
Ripping away Brick's mask, and then sustaining his story into Act 3, was Williams's challenge, and his rewrites gave Kazan precisely what he had asked for. On the first day of rehearsal, sensing a disaster, Williams wrote in his diary,
"Already making plans for a faraway flight the night the play opens in New York."
But once the show was up and running in Philadelphia, it was hard to argue with its success. The reviews were rapturous. The box office was torrid. Kazan's structural demands had given the play its satisfying wallop, and Williams knew it.
"I am being utterly sincere when I say that, on the whole, you have done one of your greatest jobs."
Williams wrote to him, signing himself,
"Devotedly."
The thing that gave Williams the most pause was the show's revised ending in which Brick was tempted back into the marital bed.
I didn't write, plan, or edit the so-called commercial third act.
Kazan wrote in his autobiography, a statement that is belied by his notes to Williams. Kazan had winkled out of Williams this softer ending, which changed the play's thematic attack on the couple. At the finale, Brick finds affirmative words sitting at the edge of the bed. He says,
I admire you, Maggie.
Maggie kneels beside him.
Oh, you weak, beautiful people who give up with such grace. What you need is someone to take hold of you, gently, with love, and hand your life back to you like something gold you let go of. And I can. I'm determined to do it. And nothing's more determined than a cat in a tin roof. Is there, baby?
For the first time, Brick allows himself to be touched by Maggie. She touches his cheek gently, the stage direction reads, a gesture that holds out the possibility of reunification. The curtain comes down on this moment of connection. In the original ending, most of which Williams restored for the 1974 Broadway production, Brick refuses to surrender to Maggie and her blandishments.
What do you say?
I don't say anything. I guess there's nothing to say.
His hatred for himself and for Maggie remains immutable. He submits to nothing but his own destructiveness. Nonetheless, Maggie whispers,
I do love you, Brick. I do.
Echoing Big Daddy's fierce words in the play's curtain line, Brick says,
Wouldn't it be funny if that was true?
The reviews of the opening night, March 24th, 1955, were sensational. Brooks Atkinson wrote, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is Mr. Williams' finest drama. Walter Kerr said, Mr. Williams is the man of our time who comes closest to hurling the actual blood and bone of life onto the stage. To Williams, each rave review was as much cause for laceration as celebration. He was convinced that for commercial success, he had sold out the truth of his characters and his heart. The published version of the play contained both endings. Williams perpetuated the legend of the play and its commercial ending in the accompanying essay, Note of Explanation, in which he portrayed himself as a hapless author, victimized by the exigencies of commercial theater and the power of his director. Williams owed Kazan more than he could admit to himself or to the public. The thrust of the original version of Cat had certainly changed, but so had the play's clarity, depth, structure, and dynamism. It won every theatrical award for best play, including the Pulitzer Prize. Yet, in a 1960 TV interview, he said,
People tell me it came off, but for me it didn't. It seemed almost like a prostitution, more a corruption.
The corruption, however, was Williams's. 10 days before the New York opening, Kazan had offered to reinstate Williams's original preferred third act. In a letter that would end their professional relationship, Kazan wrote,
You never stated that in your preface. Nor did you note that I offered repeatedly to put your original third act into the road company. You made the decision not to. It's been 4 years now that this horseshit has been in the press. You never once said a word. You should have come to my defense long ago.
And later, when offered another of Williams's plays to direct, Kazan wrote,
I'm not going to break my neck, only to be told in time again that I had misdirected your play into a hit. And then to wait and wait for you to say something and wait for nothing? What the hell kind of position is that for a man? It's not for me. Get a new boy and a new relationship.
At the same time tomorrow, you can hear Damian Lewis continue to read from Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Fresh by John Marr. Trevor White was the voice of Tennessee Williams and Alia Kazan. Beatrice Jones was Maggie and Ian Conningham, Brick. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. Coming up in Woman's Hour today, Michel Roux Sr. will be cooking the perfect ratatouille and talking about the essence of French cuisine. And we hear from UKIP's Deputy Chairman Suzanne Evans ahead of the party's conference in Doncaster. And we're in Leicester talking to the women's grassroots organisation Strive about their Raising Voices workshop.